Honey, We're Going to Africa is being read by Harvey Hoekstra, the author of the book. It is dedicated to my wife, Levina, so beautifully genuine, unpretentious, never seeking acclaim, a missionary mother with a servant heart, able to convert mud walls or sticks and grass with dirt floors into an attractive home in which there was contentment and love and where our people in Africa knew they were always welcome and could find help in times of need. To our 6 children, Denny, Jim, Dave, Carol, Mark, and Paul, who shared our adventures in Africa and the pain we experienced as a family during those long months of separation while away from home in a distant mission boarding school. To my missionary colleagues, with whom we were privileged to live and work, without whose encouragement and help our task could not have been accomplished. To God be all the honor and praise for the incredible privilege He gave to us, that we should be Christ missionaries for nearly 30 years among people who might otherwise never have heard of Him. Chapter 1. How It All Began. The year was 1946. My 1932 Ford V8 was making a fast trip from Holland to Grand Haven in Michigan. I had 21 miles to go. I could hardly wait to get home to my wife, Levina. I wondered what she'd say when I came bounding through the door with the words, "Honey, guess what? We're going to Africa." I was on my way home from the seminary, where I was preparing for the ministry. We had just been listening to a red-headed, rash, religious Presbyterian missionary from Africa named Don McClure. He had a gift to excite the imagination and challenge one to action. He told how he had come from the South Sudan beyond the Nile River, where people had never heard of Jesus Christ. God had given this man a great vision and a bold, innovative plan. They called it the Anuak Plan. 15 missionaries for 15 years to evangelize an entire tribe and then move on. He wanted to return to Africa with competent missionary recruits. People needed included a doctor, a nurse, an educationalist, an agriculturalist, an evangelist, and he was searching for someone to translate the Bible into the Anuak language. This captured my attention. I liked working with foreign languages. While a student at Hope College, I had taken German, Latin, and Greek during the same semester. As he spoke, my heart was strangely warm, and I sensed that God wanted me to be that man. After chapel was over, we gathered around and peppered our speaker with questions, wanting to learn all we could about this tremendous challenge. With these small glimpses of what was involved, I was hurrying home to tell Levina all about it. As I raced homeward about as fast as I thought was prudent, I fantasized that Levina would collapse, falling to the floor in shock, and that I'd have to revive her. And then again I'd think, no, it's not going to be that great a surprise. We've talked sometimes, albeit superficially, about being missionaries, possibly to Japan. But Africa was something else. She'd picture lions chasing her up trees, and snakes slithering in the grass, waiting to strike. Bouncing along in my Ford with its worn-out shock absorbers, I also pondered the commitment Levina had given me before we were married. I sometimes had kidded her that she wanted me real bad because she promised she'd go with me wherever the Lord called her. She said, "Honey, I know that ministers move from place to place, and I have to go wherever God calls them. I can do that with you. I'll go with you, wherever the Lord calls you." But to go out to Africa, it was still considered a dark continent and a risky place with wild animals, strange people, and threatening diseases. Our image of Africa had been shaped by Livingston and Stanley. Neither of us had thought that far ahead when we were madly in love, making far-reaching commitments to each other. One side of my brain was racing in high gear with all these and a myriad of other conflicting thoughts. The other side was praying earnestly that God would prepare Levina's heart with a positive response. Anyway, there'd be a long while before we'd have to make a final decision. I still had another year at the seminary. That'd make for a total of 3 years driving back and forth those 21 miles to attend classes while serving as student pastor at Bignall Chapel. I'll never forget the flow of adrenaline and the boundless enthusiasm with which I shared what I thought God had been showing me that morning about our going to Africa. She never collapsed, and I didn't have to pick her off the floor. but it was a turn of events she never anticipated. We prayed about it often, talked about it regularly, until finally one night when sleep eluded us, we got out of our bed around 2 o'clock in the morning and told the Lord we were going to go to Africa, if that was what He wanted us to do. That night, on our knees, our hearts were at peace, and we heard His word of promise, "I will be with you always, even to the end of the world." The old translation came to mind because to us, that's exactly where we'd be going. A scant 2 years later, a lion was in our front yard while we slept peacefully in our mud-walled house with only a mosquito net between us and him. We were at Akobo in the Sudan. Our story really begins much earlier than that fateful day when God used Don McClure to spark our interest in Africa. It begins in a tiny 8-room hospital upstairs over the pharmacy where I promised Jesus that if he'd make me well again, I'd try to be a preacher of the gospel. It was November 1935, and I had just celebrated my 15th birthday. Growing up on the farm. My boyhood home was in Minnesota. I grew up in a Christian family with 5 brothers. We never had a sister. I'm sure my mother must have been at least a little disappointed when the doctor said, "We have another boy here." I was number 4. We all went to catechism, Sunday school, and attended church as a family. When itinerant evangelists held services nearby, our family sat near the front. We lived on a dirt road 5 miles from Maple Lake. The closest school was 2 miles away, and we walked both ways except when it rained or the weather was too forbidding during the winter. Sometimes we were lucky to catch a ride if my dad or a neighbor happened to be going into town. Ours was a small farm of 80 acres. 6 or 7 acres of that grew a wide assortment of vegetables, which my dad and we boys peddled out on retail routes to homes in the various towns and among resort people spending their summer on one of the several nearby lakes. We also sold to stores and vegetable markets in the neighboring towns, reaching out as far as St. Cloud, some 27 miles distant. All of this was excellent preparation for learning how to communicate and make a sale. My dad was good at this, and he taught us boys these same skills. I can still hear him saying, "Harvey, take a head of cabbage and run up to that house and tell the lady it's only 10 cents for one, and if she'll take 3, she can have all 3 of them for 1/4. That boyhood experience trying to sell vegetables and meeting people in public was excellent preparation for a future preacher. I graduated from grade school when I was 12 years old, went to high school for a few weeks, and quit. I never went back to high school until 4.5 years later. It was during those years that I promised Jesus I'd try to become a preacher of the gospel. Illness strikes. On October 10th, in the evening, I was out beside the barn feeding the calves their evening milk. I began to feel ill with chills. It was the evening for our young people's meeting at church, and I didn't want to miss it. I went, but was miserable with chills and fever. I could hardly wait for the meeting to end so that I could go home and crawl into bed. 3 days later, when the fever had left, and I came downstairs, my mother remarked that she didn't like the way I was walking all bent over. Concerned about that, later in the week, they took me to old Dr. Russo in Maple Lake. He said that I had had an attack of appendicitis, but he didn't recommend surgery. 10 days after that first attack, the fever and chills returned. Around 6 o'clock, my folks took me to Buffalo, 16 miles from home, where I was admitted for surgery later that evening. On the way, they stopped at Uncle Ralph's farm to pick up my Aunt Marie, who was a registered nurse. The hospital was small and up a flight of stairs above the drugstore. In preparation for the surgery, I was given a spinal injection. My mother cautioned me to lie real still when they pricked me. She said Alfred Nachterborn, a neighbor boy who lived across the field from us, nearly died when they broke off the needle while attempting to give him a spinal before his operation. I never moved. During the surgery, I was fully conscious and able to hear part of the conversation as Dr. Catlin and his son Dr. Bob performed the surgery. I recall how Dr. Catlin said, "I had hoped we could have gotten that thing out of there in time." I knew then that I had a ruptured appendix and was a very sick boy. They saved the dirty black pieces of it, and I later saw them in a little bottle floating in liquid. Eventually, they threw them out. 2 weeks and 2 days after the first surgery, these same doctors again performed a second operation to deal with an abscess that had formed behind the bladder. I was desperately ill following the surgery, and it wasn't at all sure that I'd make it. This was before the miracle drugs of penicillin and sulfa had been discovered. My Aunt Marie, a registered nurse, was in the same room with me, taking care of me, night and day. A life-changing experience. On November 20, we celebrated my 15th birthday in the hospital. 2 days later, at noon, the doctor came in, pulled back the covers, tapped me on the abdomen, and said, "We're going to have to go in there once more." Another abscess had formed, into which they would insert a tube through which it could drain. My favorite aunt, Ella May, mother's younger sister, was babysitting me, keeping me company that same day. She knew that I was afraid to die, and when the doctors left the room, she got out of her chair, took hold of my trembling hand, knelt down beside my bed, and prayed. I don't know what she said. I only know that as she prayed, I had an indescribable experience of God's grace and peace. My fear was totally gone. I felt I was bathed in God's love and goodness. My heart was inexpressibly glad. It seemed that 1,000 lights were brightening up the room. I am unable adequately to describe the wonder of that experience. I felt joy, waves of joy, and God's peace washing over me. It made no difference whether I lived or died. I would be all right. I knew that God loved me. 2 hours later, my folks drove in from the country. They'd been phoned and told of the impending surgery. My mother was crying. She fully expected me to die. I remember sharing my experience with her then and telling her not to be sad or afraid. Well, as you can tell, the operation was a success, and God mercifully healed me. I went home on December 5th. I'd been in the hospital 45 days and had lost 27 pounds of weight. But before I left for home, another wonderful thing happened. A life-changing promise. On one of those days after the third operation, a retired farmer, Peter Skirmer by name, stopped by to visit me. He had been there once or twice before. To a boy just 15 years of age, he looked pretty ancient. Even so, I really appreciated his coming and making my time go just a little faster. This last visit of his, however, was surely ordained of God. Sitting just beyond the foot end of my bed, this elderly man shared with me about the experience that he'd had with their son when he was a boy like me and was ill. He said, "I had a son like you, and when he was a boy, he too was desperately ill. One day, when I came into the hospital, there was a black sheet over his bed. He wasn't there. When I saw that black sheet, I put my hands in the air and I said, 'Oh God, if you had only spared my son, I'd have given him to you.'" He continued, "As it turned out, my son was still alive. They had put him in a room across the hall, expecting him to die. And then he said, 'But God spared his life, and when he became a young man, he went to the seminary and became a preacher of the gospel.'" When I heard those words, I said in my heart, "Dear God, if you'll spare my life and make me well again, I'll try to be a preacher of the gospel." It was a commitment which by God's grace I kept, and from which I was never seriously tempted to turn aside. I knew that God had spoken to me through that retired farmer. On December 5th, 1935, I was released from the hospital. At home, I was gradually regaining strength. 2 years went by, and I was still not in school. I often prayed about it, wondering how it would ever be possible for me to become a preacher. I had been called and made a promise to God, but I was no nearer getting into school 2.5 years after leaving the hospital than I was when I said I'd be a preacher. But God has His own timing in things like that and brings it all together at His appointed time. We don't always understand these matters, but we know it to be so. Plans for getting into school. In the summer of 1937, our little country church was having a week of special evangelistic meetings. A man named Isaac Van Westenberg came from Chicago to be the week speaker. On one of those nights, he called for testimonies. Among others, I also shared from my experiences. This man had never heard of me, but that evening when I sat down, he pointed his finger straight at me and said, "Now there's a young man for the ministry." It was the finger of God. After the service, a few gathered around my folks and urged that a way be found for me to go to school. The next day I was out hoeing cabbage in the field across the road just opposite our house. A car came over the hill from the direction of the church and turned into our yard. It was Reverend Van Westenberg. He had come to follow up on the events of the preceding night at the church. I was called out of the cabbage patch, and my folks, the visiting preacher, and I sat around the kitchen table. It was agreed that I should get into school and prepare. We all decided that it might be good for me to enroll in the Northwestern Bible School in Minneapolis at the beginning of the second semester in January. That would allow me to help with the farm work through the busy fall months, too. When January came, my folks, my brother Garrett and his wife Lorene, who were living in the little house next door, took me and my trunk to the Bible school in Minneapolis. We went 2 weeks early so that I could seek out a job and support myself. I actually found a meal job in the restaurant next to the Orpheum Theater on Hennepin Avenue. It looked like I was all set to become a student at Northwestern Bible College. But this was to change dramatically. When the folks and Garrett and Glorine returned home the day they had dropped me off in the city, Garrett shared with my folks that I'd sometimes talked with him about wanting someday to attend our own theological seminary in Holland, Michigan. That conversation triggered in my dad's mind that he should visit with the superintendent of schools in Annandale and explore the possibility of my starting high school. I really didn't know what I was thinking when I spoke of going to our own seminary, when I didn't even have a high school education. But my dad realized what would first have to happen. He wasn't a strong advocate of education for his boys, but he knew that I needed one if I was to become a preacher of the gospel. 10 days after they dropped me and my trunk off at Northwestern Bible College, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I received a letter from my father. In it, he told how he had been to see the superintendent at Annandale High. Mr. Tripp, the superintendent then, had said that if I began high school immediately, I could probably catch up with the others and graduate in 3.5 years. There was precedent for that kind of accelerated attempt. Henry, that is, Hank Scott, who later married my cousin Hazel, had gone back to school when he was older. He had graduated in 3 years, and I had heard a lot of people talk about what he had done. By 4 o'clock that afternoon, I was out on the road hitchhiking the 50 miles home. Once in Maple Lake, I called my dad and he collected me. It was already past 8 o'clock in the evening before we arrived home. We sat together around the kitchen table discussing this new possibility. By 10 o'clock that night, the decision had been made. I would go back to the city the next afternoon, Sunday, collect my trunk, and begin high school in Annandale. Wilbert Scott drove me to the school in Minneapolis that afternoon. Attending high school in Annandale. The next day, Monday morning, January 24, 1938, the school bus stopped at our mailbox to pick me up. Annandale was 7 miles from home. I began my high school education that day. 2.5 years later, I graduated with honor. It had been hard work, but God had marvelously helped me. I never took an examination without asking the Lord to help me. Some sacrifices were necessary to achieve. To catch up with the other students, I spent the first few Saturdays studying the entire day in the little vacant house on our farm. It was a great challenge, and I loved it. I often studied late into the evening. Sometimes I'd go to bed real early, set the alarm, and begin studying at 2:30 in the morning. We always had cows to milk and chores to do as well. And during my second year, I even took 7 weeks off from school on Thursdays to go out alone with the truck to sell vegetables on a route I had in Monticello. During the school year, I didn't participate in most of the young people's social activities and good times. I did continue teaching Sunday school and always attended the weekly teachers' meeting. Reverend Adolphus Dykstra, our young pastor, was such an excellent teacher that none of us who taught on Sunday wanted to miss out. Attending Hope College in Holland, Michigan. In May 1940, I graduated from high school. That same fall, my folks and I traveled from Minnesota to Michigan in their nice 1937 Chevy. My dad always kept his car in tip-top shape, so it was a first-class ride all the way. I was excited. The first hurdle of finishing high school was behind me. I was eager to start at Hope College and complete my formal education. I was highly motivated because of the promise I'd made when I'd been so ill. It never occurred to me that I wouldn't make it. The college had a job lined up for me, taking care of a woman's furnace and yard on 13th Street right near the school. We met this lady in the afternoon, and I expected to move into my room in the morning. My dad handed me a dollar bill just before they left for Chicago, where they'd visit relatives on their way home. His last word, as I recall it, was, "You'd better get yourself a haircut." I had no idea of what lay ahead. In the morning, I learned that the lady had changed her mind. I don't know whether she didn't like my looks or what went wrong. Anyway, I ended up staying with an older lady named Miss Duesberg, living on 10th Street between College and Central Avenue. It was close to the college, and I liked that. My duties were easy enough. Carry in the coal for the space heater and empty out the ashes, help with odd jobs around the place, and be available in case of need. I also found a job in the Dutch Mill restaurant, where I could earn my meals. That first semester, I skipped classes 3 days each month so that I could read light and water meters for the city. When my friend Howard Van Eggman quit his job as night clerk in the Hotel Netherlands, I applied and was accepted. John Scott, a boyhood friend from Maple Lake, who was attending Hope College, was rooming with me at Miss Duesberg. At this juncture, he took over my responsibilities in the house. Employment at the Netherlands Hotel involved long hours, 7 nights a week, but it was a good job for a college student having to work. It gave me the opportunity to study on the job. My classes were in the morning, and I slept afternoons. When I received my first grades, I was surprised to find that I had done better than I'd hoped for. I suspect I had set my academic sights a little too low, and never thought that I might be able to maintain the good record I finished up with in high school. But sensing that I could probably finish near the top of my class, if I really tried, I began to study more seriously, like I had in high school. Taking 9 hours of credit work summers, I could come close to graduating in 3 years. I did this and finished the remaining several hours required to graduate during my first year at Western Seminary. One of my summer school courses was in Japanese history. Dr. Albertus Peters, who had spent years in Japan as an RCA missionary and later taught at Western Seminary, was the teacher. He'd retired by then, but former students still talked about how they'd never go into his classroom unprepared. Dr. Peters, for some strange reason, wasn't much in favor of students working and studying at the same time. I was holding down a full-time night job while going to school during the summer. I've always considered that Dr. Peters paid me one of my highest compliments during my college years when he gave me a grade of 99 1/4 in one of his comprehensive examinations. As he returned my paper, he snorted in his mustache in his inimical manner, saying, "Mr. Hoekstra, I don't know how you do it, but I can't deny the facts." I still chuckle whenever I recall how he said it. When I received my diploma, it was cum laude, with honor. I knew it was because God had helped me and gave him thanks and praise. Married while still at Hope. I was a very busy young man during those student years. Even so, I managed to court an attractive young lady, Levina Hoffman, and we were married while I was still at Hope. She was God's gift to me, beautiful, sensible, supportive, and never prepared to give up. Looking back, we concede that getting married when we did may not have been the smartest thing to do. But God sometimes graciously overrules for good, even when we may not know what's the best for ourselves. It wasn't easy. Levine and I were normally poor and lacking some of the amenities of life, but we had each other. When our first son, Denny, made his debut, 11 months after we were married, we knew we had our work cut out for us. Sometimes we wondered where our next meal would come from. Many a can of soup made its way to our table. Occasionally we'd look at each other and say, "The Lord must be getting us ready for Arabia or something." At that time, we had no idea that it was Africa. Though the going was tough, we both worked to put food on the table and pay our way. Quitting school was never an option. It never occurred to either of us that we wouldn't make it or that I should drop out. It simply wasn't an option. We would look to God to see us through, and we were willing to do whatever was required. I think our lowest point came one day when, during the college year, out of work, I had taken a day out from classes to look for a job. All prospects for job openings had come to a dead end. Nothing was available. I finally stopped at one of the factories where a man whom I didn't know but who said his name was Ed Boovy gave me hope. He said I should go to the Boone Aluminum Company and ask to speak to the man in charge. He said, "I'll call him and tell him you'll be showing up." This was encouraging because most of those places were simply taking names down, and one never got in to see anyone at all. Eventually, I was at the little opening in the outer lobby where you filled out the forms. After waiting longer than I had hoped would be the case, inasmuch as Mr. Boovy was supposed to have called them, the manager invited me into his office. He confirmed that he'd been contacted. At one point, I said, "I don't care what job I have to do. I'm willing to clean spittoons or do anything. I need work." This kind man raised his hand and stopped me, saying, "Take it easy, fellow. Take it easy. We'll find something for you." They gave me a job working nights in the tool crib, where I'd sharpen tools and give them out to the workers. Whenever they needed to turn in their dull cutting tools for replacements, I would have sharpened. I'd never seen the inside of a factory before. To learn the job, I had to skip classes at Hope College for 1 week. The following week, I began at midnight, came home in the morning after 8 o'clock, changed into clean clothes quickly to make classes at Hope. In the afternoon and early evening, I tried to sleep. It was a good job. The pay was 3 times what I'd earned at the hotel, and I could still study on the job. Some of the factory workers knew I was studying and tried to avoid disturbing me as much as possible. Some even sharpened their own tools. I suspect they could do it better than this college student with his limited experience at that. The Lord was so kind and merciful to me. Later, when I started seminary, Levina began working nights and switched back and forth between second and third shifts. Jenny was just a little tyke then. Jenny Scott, our dear friend from Minnesota who was living next door, took care of him. Jenny and her daughter Elsie were like a grandmother and auntie to Denny. During one period, every morning before going to class, I would transport Denny in a basket on the front of my bike to get him over to our friends Bill and Kay Vandenberg. If it rained, we covered him with plastic. This was when Levina was working the day shift and I was in seminary. Our first summer assignment to preach. Seminary students were normally sent out on summer assignments. Some went to help in local church ministries, and 2 or 3 students always went to the Indian mission fields in New Mexico or Nebraska. We were the only married couple in seminary at that time, so Levine and I, with our 2-year-old son Denny, would be going out together. We'd been assigned to Winnebago, Nebraska, but before this was finalized, we were reassigned to Bignall Chapel near Grand Haven. The change was made because during that same time, Levina's mother, living in Holland, Michigan, was gravely ill. Again, we saw the marvelous providence of God at work in these events. First of all, we met Franklin and Gladys Keith, who in later years would play such an important role in our lives and ministry. When our summer assignment ended, this little preaching post called Bignall Chapel, where I'd been preaching 2 sermons every Sunday, invited us to continue on as their student pastor. They wanted us to keep on living there and serve them like a pastor until I completed my seminary training. Every day during the school year, I drove our 32 Ford V8, the 21 miles back and forth to seminary. Every Sunday, two more sermons were waiting to be preached. It was my great joy, but also my ever-present burden. More than one message received its final touches well past Saturday at midnight. It was great that Levina didn't have to work those long hours outside the home any longer. She loved watching Denny develop and teaching him all those things a good mother does. I suspect her stories included the boys and girls from Africa. Sometimes Levina and I talked about the peoples of the world who had never heard of Jesus. We'd talk about America, where the churches were so plentiful, where radio programs put the gospel within reach of almost everyone. We sometimes spoke about our becoming missionaries to Japan, but not really seriously. We never talked about becoming missionaries to Africa, that is, until that day when Don McClure visited our seminary. Africa in our blood. In the summer of 1946, Levine and I attended the New Wilmington Missionary Conference in Ohio. We met a number of missionaries there on furlough, and some who were new recruits. We felt right at home with them, and Africa was in our blood. It was a summer that confirmed our call to Africa. Levine and I talked incessantly about Africa. We must have talked about the rivers, rain, and mud as we speculated and tried to visualize what living in Africa might be like. That we were doing a lot of this became apparent one rainy day when we drove out to the country over muddy roads to pick up a side of pork from a local farmer. Denny was in the back seat, and when the car came to a halt, he excitedly started hitting his mother on the shoulder to get her attention. And what do you think he wanted to know? His question, "Is this Africa, Mommy? Is this Africa?" To him, Africa was a place of rain and mud, and he thought we were there. Appointed by the RCA. During this time when God was calling us to serve in Africa, the Reformed Church in America, RCA, was making its decision to expand its missionary program to include Africa. The RCA and the United Presbyterians were to become partners in the work of the American Mission, the name of the Presbyterian Mission in the Sudan. The RCA had caught this vision from this same Don McClure. Bob and Maury Swart and Wilma Katz would be the first to go out. We'd be following them in a few short months. But before all that happened, there were still some hurdles to overcome and training we needed in order to be ready for the task lying ahead. During our last year at Western Seminary, we formally applied to be accepted by the RCA to serve with the Presbyterians in Africa. The forms to be filled out seemed long and complicated. There were hurdles to overcome. But eventually, one night, the phone rang. We were just about to step out of the house to leave for our weekly young people's meeting in the church. Bev Vandermeiden, a young teenage neighbor girl, was standing there waiting to ride with us when the phone rang. On the line was Miss Ruth Ransom from the RCA's Board of World Missions meeting in Kalamazoo. She was calling to tell us that Levina and I had just been appointed by them to serve in Africa. They wanted us to come to Kalamazoo the next day to be introduced to the entire board and to meet with their committee to make future plans. It was a night we can never forget. That same year, in May 1947, I graduated from Western Theological Seminary in Holland. We'd had 3 marvelous years serving as student pastor while attending seminary. And suddenly, this was all past tense. The RCA mapped out the additional preparation we should have before leaving for overseas. After a year at Skerritt and Peabody Colleges in Nashville, Tennessee, and a summer at the University of Oklahoma in the Summer Institute of Linguistics, SIL, of the Wycliffe Bible Translators, we were ready to push off. But there were innumerable details needing attention, passport forms to fill out, inoculations that gave us fevers and sore arms, furniture, food supplies, and tools to accompany us, visits to family members and visits to a number of supporting congregations, eager to meet their new missionaries and bid them Godspeed. Everywhere we went, people encouraged us and tried to help us in any way possible. Several men helped build wooden cases that could also serve as cabinets for furniture. Going to Africa, we needed guns and ammunition for hunting. Our meat supply was out there somewhere in the tall grass or perhaps flying overhead. We'd become expert shots as we kept meat on the table. We'd be in lion and leopard country, so we'd also need guns for our own protection. Sailing for Africa. It was July 2, 1948, when we sailed for Africa. Our dear friends, Arnie and Marge Van Lommel, had come from where they were serving a church in New Jersey to see us off. Reverend Bert Bossenbrook, representing the board, gave us their official send-off, and he led us in prayer. We were on a newly refurbished freighter named the SS Steel Apprentice. They allowed 11 passengers. To carry more meant they'd have to include a doctor. Late in the afternoon, our friends had already left, and we started moving out to sea. We were all out on the deck watching the shoreline gradually recede in the distance. It was beginning to darken. As the Statue of Liberty was fading in the distance, we suddenly felt an indescribable sense of aloneness. Nobody was with us, and we were desolate. I thought to myself, what have I done? I'm taking my family to a place I've never seen, and where there are dangers I can't even imagine. Levina wasn't feeling that chipper either. It was the moment of truth. There was no turning back. We were committed. The bands had stopped playing. All the nice words said about our courage and how great it was that we were going out as missionaries were past history. We were alone, and nobody spoke to us.
About that time, we took Denny, who was 5.5 years, and Jimmy, who was just 3 months old, and went into our cabin. We opened the Bible, and it fell to Psalm 105, where we read these beautiful, unforgettable words. When they were few in number, of little account, and sojourners in it, wandering from nation to nation, from one kingdom to another people, he allowed no one to oppress them. He rebuked kings on their account, saying, "Touch not my anointed ones, do my prophets no harm." We closed the book, got on our knees together, and prayed. When we opened our eyes, it was like we were in another world. The loneliness and desolation had been lifted. Our hearts were at peace, and we experienced his presence and peace. This terrible feeling never returned, but it was a moment we will never forget. How precious indeed are the promises of God to strengthen the hearts of those who lean on him.
16 days later, we docked at Port Said in Egypt. We would soon set our feet on African soil.